Welcome to Season 2 of the Good Market Podcast. I'm your host, Harry Cunningham. Each month, we hear from good people with great products, supporting exceptional causes, and making incredible impacts on communities around the world. Join us now as we hear another good story about impact that's happening right near you. Well, it's an exciting day for me here at the Good Market Live podcast to get to spend a little time talking to one of my friends that I've had in the purpose-driven space for perhaps the longest time that I've known anything about this purpose-driven space. I'm happy to welcome Scott Harrison to the Good Market Live podcast. Scott, welcome.
Well, it's fun to be here. That makes me just feel old.
Makes me feel a little old too. But
I was saying I had a similar conversation the other day that when I started, the term social entrepreneur wasn't a term. And now it seems like everybody and their mother is a social entrepreneur.
Everybody's
right?
A social entrepreneur, exactly. And it's kind of fun for us too, because this is our September episode, and September is an important month for Charity Water, an important month for you, obviously your birth month. But I'd love to just kind of let's jump right in, go back to the early days of Scott. And I know the story, but I'm anxious for you to sort of tell the story about your childhood and then how things sort of changed. And we'll get into that part, but let's jump back to the beginning.
Well, I was born in Philadelphia in a very middle-class family. My dad was a business guy, something to do with electrical engineering. And my mom was a writer. And when I was four, we moved into this very ugly gray house in South Jersey at the end of a cul-de-sac in the dead of winter. And what we did not know about the house we just bought was it came with a carbon monoxide gas leak. That was free. So we move into the house. We all start getting these weird headaches and symptoms. And on New Year's Day, 1980, my mom walks across the bedroom and she collapses unconscious. So she's the canary in the coal mine, which leads to massive amounts of carbon monoxide in her blood. And then the discovery of the furnace that was causing the leak. So this was kind of a traumatic event. My dad and I did recover, but my mom never did. So she was disabled for the rest of her life. And what happened was her immune system just shut down. And its ability to process anything chemical, anything synthetic from that point was just forever compromised. So they made a movie many years ago called, I think it was called Bubble Boy. Yeah. And that was kind of my mom. She lived in isolation. She lived in special rooms covered in aluminum foil. Unfortunately, I have over 40 years of experience now with 3M's full family of masks, from the N95 to charcoal masks to, we tried every single different mask. And I never really saw my mom's face from that point on, as she just kind of lived in small rooms and ate very bizarre food. So I was an only child. Family planning stopped after this accident. And, my parents tried to give me the most normal childhood as possible, but I was a caregiver. I was taking care of mom. Mm-hmm. I was doing the cooking. I was doing the cleaning. I would, when I was older, take her to her, her doctor visits. And grew up in a family of faith. So my parents would call themselves non-denominational Christians. And my dad would certainly credit his faith for making the marriage work under such duress. So I really, respected him, and he had a lot of integrity, and didn't run off with his secretary, but took care of a very sick woman for my whole childhood. So I was raised in the church. If you'd asked me what I was going to be when I grew up at 15, I would have said, I'm going to be a doctor, and I'm going to cure my mom, and then I'm going to cure all the other sick people I met just like her. Well, we would not have met had I become a doctor. Instead of becoming a doctor, to the horror of my parents, at 18 years old, I joined a rock band. I grew my hair down on my shoulders, and I moved to New York City to make it rich and famous, and to sleep with pretty girls, and to drink, and to smoke, and to do drugs, and really chase parties around the world. And, probably couldn't have been farther from the conservative background. But I think in a way I was maybe trying to look for a lost childhood. Yeah. So I did not become a rock star, but I did become a nightclub promoter, and a very successful one at that.
Maybe so more important than a rock star, actually.
Well, I mean, we would host the rock stars, right? we would decide who got in to the club past the velvet rope and the one way glass. So, for the next 10 years in Manhattan, I filled up 40 different nightclubs, with, you know, the rich and beautiful famous people. And you know what this is like. You sell a vodka yep. Red Bull for $25 that costs you 25 cents to make.
Yeah.
And people will line up to buy these. And you know, I started collecting all of these markers of success over this decade in New York. So it started with the BMW and then the Rolex and then the Loft and then the grand piano and then the model girlfriend who was in the cover of, you know, Vogue or Elle or I can't even remember, Cosmopolitan, something like that. Yeah. And you know, after 10 years of chasing all the wrong things, I woke up one day and realized, wow, I'm really unhappy.
Yeah.
I'm emotionally bankrupt. I'm morally bankrupt. I'm spiritually bankrupt. And if I died, you know, the only thing I could think of that they would write on my tombstone is, here lies a nightclub promoter who's gotten a million people drunk. Or worse.
Or worse.
So, you know, this was a real this was a real kind of cathartic event. I had some health issues, which, you know, I guess helped me face my mortality and question all the stuff from my childhood. You know, did I believe in heaven and hell? Like, if any of that was true, I knew where I was going after the 10 years of
the wrong way,
decadent living. Yeah. And really just kind of examined my life and decided to start over and kind of clean the slate. I think I realized, Harry, a pivot was not needed. A 180 degree change was needed.
Yeah.
So go
a total turn. Yeah.
Find the exact opposite of everything I had, you know, spoken and thought and done and see where that might take me. So the big idea I had was to, there's this kind of biblical concept of the tithe. So I said, well, I've selfishly wasted 10 years. What if I gave 1 year in service to others? And my idea was I was going to join a volunteer mission for 1 year and see if I could be useful. Mm-hmm. And that was, let's say, 20 years ago. So I was 18 at the time. I was 28 at the time. Yes, I was 28 at the time.
We'll take those 10 years out. So, I think I met you shortly after that, but there's an interesting twist, I think, that I know about, and I'm sure you've shared this before as well, about this idea of volunteering, but you couldn't actually get to volunteer right away.
It was harder than I thought. It was harder than I thought. So I wasn't giving to charity for these 10 years. I mean, I remember once I attached a charity to a party I threw at a club called Lotus in the meatpacking.
Yep.
And I mean, I'm embarrassed to say we might have given 1% of the money to the charity, you know, just so we could use their name. So I didn't really know anything about the space. So I just started applying to, you know, Save the Children and, you know, Doctors Without Borders and World Vision and the Red Cross and the Salvation Army. Well, it turns out that none of these organizations are looking for a nightclub promoter. In fact, Doctors Without Borders is looking for doctors.
Yeah.
and not club rats. So, you know, I was denied by the first 10 or so organizations that I applied to. And then I was very fortunate. I'd gone to New York University kind of part-time. I'd really mailed it in and, you know, C-minus student, but I had gotten a bachelor's degree in communications. So I dust off this degree that I've never used and I apply to this one organization. I say, I'll be your photojournalist. Okay. I'm going to write and I'm going to take pictures of all the amazing work I'm sure you're doing. And they write me back and they say, okay, but you have to pay us $500 a month for the pleasure of volunteering. And you have to go live in the poorest country on planet Earth, a country called Liberia, West Africa, that had just come out of a 14-year civil war. So this sounded perfect to me. I mean, this was really the opposite of my life. And my life changed dramatically in just a period of a few weeks. I went from high-end nightclubs to joining this medical mission, a group of doctors and surgeons in a country where there was no running water, no sewage system, no electricity, no power grid working in the country, and one doctor for every 50,000 people living there.
Crazy. What did your friends in New York think when you said, hey, I'm done?
I mean, if I'm honest, they thought it was cool because it was boring, Harry. I mean, you go to the same clubs with the same people and the DJ plays the same songs. So I think, you know, they were excited to live vicariously through somebody they knew. That's getting cool. out and changing you know, everything about their life and going on this journey with me.
So this photojournalism thing, I think, is really an interesting approach, and one that I learned early on about you is your skill as a photographer, which I didn't know, you know, having experienced it firsthand. It's not something that you talk about a lot necessarily, but I'm proud to say that I have from Charity Ball, and we'll talk about Charity Ball in a minute, but I have one of the squares hanging on my wall at home right now from one of the large images that you took, and we bought squares for $20 and we filled the wall and we got to take one home. Mm. I mean, had you explored photojournalism at all, or was this just like, I'm going to wing it, I'll just fake it till I make it kind of thing?
I mean, Harry, you're very kind. I think to this day, you know, I'm a mediocre photographer at best. I was a hobby photographer. I mean, I would take pictures of model girlfriends, you know, in Paris, you know, in Montmartre, you know, or something. It was a hobby. You know, I was a pretty, yeah. I was probably a better writer than a photographer. I'd worked at a local paper in high school and, yeah, you know, loved to read and loved to write. So journalism came easier to me than the photography. But cool. I think the cool thing was when I joined this group called Mercy Ships, I had 15,000 emails on my club list. And back then, you know, email open rates were basically 100%, right? You sent an email everybody read it.
Everybody read it, yeah.
So, you know, my list went from getting invitations to the Prada megastore opening in Soho, mm-hmm. or, you know, MTV's after party with, you know, Perry Farrell or something DJing, to images of 5,000 sick people, you know, waiting for our doctors, you know, to be triaged, and images of 8.5 hour surgeries as people were getting their faces transformed and tumors removed and cleft lips and cleft palates fixed and cataract surgeries. So people were really interested, and it was such a visual subject matter. I mean, we were removing tumors, giant facial tumors from people. We were, you know, we would meet somebody who's 30 years old who had cataracts that, you know, were completely blocking their eyes. And in a 20-minute surgery, you know, they could see again.
Yeah.
Or some people could see for the first time in their lives.
And so you were sending all this information out to the people back
like
home,
it or not.
Like,
well, I mean,
it was,
I,
like it or not. But you were getting
some
responses.
Unsubscribes. There were definitely some unsubscribes, you know.
So,
hey, bro,
so
that party you threw was cool, but like, I don't need a tumor in my face.
Delete, right? So you're out for a year and you're there with no power. But so how, like, this is back in the days of
dial-up.
Yeah,
we're living on a
right?
hospital ship. So there was a 522 foot ocean liner, which had been converted to a state of the art hospital. And this group had a very simple mission. Sail this giant hospital ship up and down the coast of Africa and bring people on it, provide the highest level of medical services, and then send them off back on land, you know, with a transformed, healthy life.
And was there ever a time that you were like, what am I doing? This is the wrong thing. Or was there more of a time about this is exactly what I need to be doing?
I loved it. I mean, it was the best year of my life.
So I've heard you talk about one of the doctors that you met that was supposed to be there, I think, for a short time and ended up staying for years. What do you think kept you from staying for years? Because, you know, if you loved it, like, what was sort of the transformational moment that said to you, okay, this is it, but I can do something bigger?
Yeah, well, I did a year, and I took 50,000 photos that first year, and then the ship kind of ended that outreach. And I went back to New York City, and I got a gallery donated in Chelsea, and I put up 108 of my photos, and I just tried to raise money through the gallery for more surgeries. And I wound up raising about $100,000 in donations through that show. And then I didn't know what was next. So I did go back for another year. Mm-hmm. And there was this idea too of following the money. You know, I wanted to show my friends that the hospital ship is not now, it hasn't turned into a Virgin cruise now, you know. we're not driving, you know, Lexuses with gold rims around Africa because they gave, you know, our doctors are helping more people. More surgeries, more lives are being transformed. So I really kind of went back and followed the money. And then it was that second tour where I really got exposure to dirty water. Mm-hmm. I got off the ship. I got out of Monrovia, the capital city. And as I went into the rural areas, I saw people drinking dirty, disgusting, diseased water for the first time in my life. And I learned two important things. I learned that half of the country was drinking disgusting water And I learned half the disease in the country was because people were drinking dirty water and didn't have access to sanitation, toilets. So that was really my big aha. You know, here we are with these doctors only able to help, you know, maybe 1,000, 1,500 people every year. But there are millions of people that are sick that didn't need to be sick if they just had the most basic need for health met in clean water. And I remember watching a well get drilled. And, you know, it was just such an unbelievable thing to be in a community with a couple hundred people, watching them drink water from a green, viscous swamp, crawling with insects, crawling with bugs. Wow. You're watching little girls effectively dying in front of me as they drink contaminated water, and then realizing that underneath there was clean water. So underneath that village, there was an aquifer of clean water, but the village right didn't there. Have wow. $10,000, let's say, to tap into that. So I remember actually sharing with Dr. Gary, this doctor, as you mentioned, who'd signed up for a few weeks he'd signed up for 3 months and stayed 20 years. I remember just sharing these images that I was taking of what people were drinking. And he said, yeah, why don't you go work on this problem? You know, you seem passionate about this. Rather than going and raising, you know, the next $100,000 for us to do a bunch of cleft lip surgeries, why don't you just go and make sure everybody in the world has clean water? And it seemed so simple. it seemed so simple.
Little did you know. Little did you know.
Little
so,
did I know.
So I'm not sure which came first, the name or the idea, but obviously you know he kind of gave you this mission to go do clean water. So bring us back to New York and sort of how you started the first sort of big fundraiser and decided to do the first well.
Well, yeah, the name, you know, at first, actually, I came back and I said, you know, I think there's a problem with charity, because as I was talking to my friends, and again, I had the benefit here. I was 30 years old. My only experience was as a club promoter for 10 years and then running around taking pictures of the good work of doctors and surgeons. And in this case, you know, this well driller at the end. So the people that I knew worked at Sephora. You know, they worked at Saks. They worked at Chase Bank. They worked at VH1. And I realized there was a huge lack of trust when it came to giving money to charity. And as I started to research this, you know, I remember a poll by USA Today found 42% of Americans don't trust charities.
Wow.
A more recent study by New York University found 70% of Americans believe charities waste their money. I mean, 7 out of 10 people, right? It's That's like the crazy, charity has one job.
Yeah.
Right? Don't waste people's money.
And they're wasting people, or people think
they're
wasting
people
their
money. They are, right?
Yeah.
So I thought, wow, I mean, if we're going to make a dent in an issue as big as the global water crisis, right? At the time, there were 1 billion people without water. That's 3 Americas full of people globally that were drinking disgusting water every day. We're going to need to address this charitable trust issue. You know, if we want everyday people to give, you know, not the Gates Foundations of the world or these kind of, you know, seasoned savvy philanthropists. I wanted everyday people. I wanted somebody at Sephora to give $50. So, you know, the name at the beginning was just charity. And, you know, I was running around saying, you know, my name is Scott Harrison. And I started a charity called Charity.
Called Charity.
And we were going to do everything different. And we're going to start with water. But then I was gonna copy Richard Branson and launch, you know, charity education, charity healthcare, you know, charity shelter, right? I was gonna kind of, it was charity colon. We'd start with water and then we would launch 10 different initiatives. And the big idea we had was to promise the public that 100% of all their donations would go directly, in this case, to build water projects and help people get clean water. And in a separately audited bank account, in another bank account with a different set of numbers, we would raise all that nasty, gross overhead separately. The staff salaries, the office rent, the toner for the Epson copy machine, the phone bills, the flights to Africa and later India and Southeast Asia, all that would be raised separately from a small group of entrepreneurs and business leaders and donors, so that 100% of the public's money can go straight to clean water projects. And then kind of the second big idea was, all right, well, now that we have this two bank account model, let's build technology to track these small donations and show people exactly where they went.
Right.
And, you know, one just simple example, we became the first charity in the world to geolocate every water project on Google Earth and then later Google Maps. So we could show
people. You might find
this
funny. I don't know if you remember, I did a well for my 40th birthday and I still have my geo track. I know exactly where my well is today.
Oh, that's
some I could probably, many, many years later.
And I could probably go online and we could look at it. So, you know, sometimes people could actually see the satellite images of these projects, which is really cool. So, put that together, Charity Water. Oh, you're right. Harry Cunningham, 40th and Friends, and you are in Ethiopia. You are in northern Ethiopia.
Yep.
That is super cool. It's a spring protection called Ma Areda, and there's 200 people there.
How about that?
That is very
cool.
That's funny. I just put your name in the search engine and saw it.
And there I was.
And I've been to Ethiopia 31 times, and the need is very, very great in that country and specifically in that region. So we started in a nightclub. That's the only idea I had at the time, was to get a club donated. It was Fashion Week in New York, and I gave everybody open bar for an hour, got that donated. And to come into my 31st birthday party, you had to donate $20. And we had this big plexi box. And I remember at the end of the night, we'd collected $15,000. I don't get to tell this story often, but I remember that there was a $500 wad of cash in there.
Wow.
And I learned it came from a weed dealer. And I knew him. And you know, we kind of asked him later. And he said, this is the first charitable gift I've ever given in my life. But I know exactly where this $500 is going. And that 100% of it is going to help people.
That's cool.
So it was a really, you know, not that would later be our market.
Yeah.
But you know, the maybe one of the most cynical people that I knew, you know, was moved by this idea that people needed clean water and was willing to give. So we took the $15,000, we counted it, we audited it, we took 100% of that money to northern Uganda, and we built our first well, and we fixed a couple adjacent ones. And then we sent the photos and the GPS coordinates and the satellite images and video back to those 700 people. And we said, here's where your money went.
That's cool.
You did this. Mm-hmm. And we realized there was just something so powerful about the 100% promise and then closing the loop that, you know, we could really have a distinctive as an organization. We could reinvent or reimagine the charitable experience if we baked that idea into the DNA of everything we would do.
And I think that idea of transparency then, and certainly something you've been, you know, commended for many, many times over, that idea of transparency is so important, and maybe even more important today because of that foundation that you laid, that sort of groundwork that you did first, is like showing people where their money is going. And it's funny for me to hear that you know, say that 70% now people don't trust charities. But I think those that are being more transparent are certainly gaining trust, and
it's pushing
those others to be more transparent. And you know, are there other organizations that you are aware of that are doing that sort of two bank account model?
Yeah, more and more. I mean, it's difficult, right? You kind of have two different organizations that you have to run in perfect balance at all time. But I think, look, at the end of the day, you know, donors just want to know where their money's going.
Yeah.
And people are open to myriad value propositions. I mean, if I told your listeners right now that actually the greatest need at Charity Water is a copy machine for whatever reason, I mean, people would donate the money for a copy machine to move the mission forward. Now, there's no more overheady thing than a, you know, $1,000 copy machine. But I think that's it. People just want to know where their money is going and what needs they are meeting as they sacrificially give. So I think, you know, we preach transparency more than the 100% model. You know, that was right for us 17 years ago when we started. But I think, you know, a transparent organization can also be wildly successful without that model.
Yeah. Interesting. So I want to talk about you and your family a little bit, and then we'll jump back to Charity Water. So you're a dad of three now. I'm an only child as well, and grew up with a similar situation young in my childhood that certainly changed how I approach things. But how do you think that childhood changed you as a dad? And what's your sort of proudest dad moment so far?
I mean, I over-optimize for fun. So I don't know if there's any Enneagram people out there. I'm like an 8-7, but I really want to be a 7. So all the fun that I didn't think I got in my childhood,
right?
I mean, I'm a roller coaster dad. You know, I'm like, let's go buy the fast pass and ride 30 roller coasters with any kid that wants to do that.
That's I'm the same, yeah.
You know, my son did 20 flights in his first 12 months. I mean, he doesn't remember any of it, but
sure.
You know, my kids come with me, and I do a lot of speaking. I do a lot of traveling. I've been to 72 countries now, and they've had some great experiences kind of, you know, alongside the work. I got to take them. Well, I've got a baby, so he didn't go, but I got to take my 7 and 9 year old to Africa for the first time this year.
Wow.
And, you know, it was a really cool experience. You know, my kids had seen me speak, you know, they've seen the photos, they've seen the videos, but you know, walking with them in East Africa, actually in the country where we did our first well of now, what, 137,000 or so, was really special.
Amazing. So let's go back to the story for a minute. So you start this first well, you get great response, and you think, maybe I'm on to something, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that was what year, first well?
That was 2006. That was September 2006.
So you and I met shortly thereafter, really alongside. It was a September moment that then was followed up by the charity ball.
Well, it's a good story, Harry. Yeah. I mean, I met somebody in the Mercer Hotel, and they said, you got to go meet my friend Terry Schaefer. He's at Saks Fifth Avenue. And, you know, I remember sitting with Terry and kind of pitching him this idea of clean water. And he wasn't really vibing with it. I mean, you know, dirty water pictures and a luxury customer at Saks. Like, I don't think he could find the connection. Yeah. But at the very end of the meeting, for some reason, we started talking about my mom, and he was so moved by her story, and he had something in his past. I don't remember the details, but we wound up spending probably another hour together after that. And he said, you know, look, I'm going to advocate for you, and this would be really cool if we took this on. I mean,
yeah.
Everybody at Saks could care about clean water for humans. And he introduced me to Steve, the CEO at the time. And, you know, the next thing I knew, you know, here's Saks kind of taking a risk on a fledgling charity that's a year old and taking out 108 stores and giving us visibility among, you know, on windows of Fifth Avenue. I think we had the windows of Fifth Avenue for a month.
That's right.
As we put up photos and we built wells inside these stores, and catalogs were shot in water. And, you know, we'd hear these stories of a woman coming in to buy a $10,000 Balenciaga bag and walking out with a $10,000 well. she could buy both, right? If you have money for a nice handbag, you could also help a community get water. So I think we raised about $750,000 through that campaign. But maybe even more importantly, a lot of awareness and a lot of credibility that really helped us kind of, you know, launch, again, a year into the organization.
Yeah. One of the things I remember, well, first, really, a quick note about Terry Schaefer. Anybody that hasn't been lucky enough to spend any time with him hasn't really lived, in my opinion. I mean, he's so, you know, he is that guy that's like, okay, whatever. But then you hit that moment, strike that chord with him, and he has such a warm heart. Mm-hmm. And he does see the things like he saw with you and in the organization. So, I mean, kudos to him. I miss him, and we do keep in touch, but I miss him. And he's a great guy. So anyway, back to the Saks thing. One of my greatest memories of Saks is something that's really become iconic for you too, is that jerry can. And I know we had them stacked up in the windows, and I remember you know, walking, carrying them to kind of replicate what women were doing to go get clean water for their families. But can you talk about the jerry can a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, it's this yellow can. It's a plastic kind of rectangle. And, well, I mean, people know what this is. You would have them in your garages full of fuel, you know, next to your lawnmower or your riding mower. This is how hundreds and hundreds of millions of people around the world store their water and carry their water. And, you know, it came from the Germans. So it's called Jerry after the Germans. And kind of as the Germans were pressing into Africa during the war, they would fuel their move with these jerry cans. And then they kind of stuck in Africa and really became a symbol for water. So that's been, you know, that's our logo, that's our trademark logo, and, you know, kind of the symbol of the maybe the gap between the 90% of the world that I mean, I bet, listen, almost everybody listened to this podcast today. You just took water for granted your entire day. Yep. You woke up and it was there, and maybe it came out of your refrigerator, and you know, you took a bottle with you to the gym or to yoga, and you brushed your teeth with clean water, and you made your coffee with clean water, and you took a shower, and you flushed your toilet with clean water. And 10% of the world has never had that experience. I mean, has never had that experience simply because of the conditions they were born into. You know, in the same way that, you know, you and I, Harry, didn't choose to be born into the 90%.
Yeah, right.
So I think, that's been kind of our symbol of, you know, we want everybody to have access to clean and safe water. And eventually we'd like it to come from a tap, not, you know, fill a can, a gas can that you're walking an hour, you know, to some faraway source.
Amazing. So fast forward to now, and I'd love to talk a bit about what's going on now. So obviously pandemic, you relocated, but the company, and I'll call it a company, even though it's a charity, because like you said, it is really still a business as well, has grown pretty substantially. So what are some of the accomplishments that you've had along the way that you're most proud of?
Well, we've helped a lot of people. You know, we've helped about 17.4 million people get access to water now. Across 137,000 villages, you know. So what started with one well, through a party where a bunch of people came and tossed $20 in a bin, you know, is now turned into, you know, 137,000 villages, and it's really been a grassroots movement. I mean, even the Saks example, that $750,000 was powered by lots of micro donations. By, you know, team members at Saks giving $10 in cash out of their paycheck. You know, I mentioned a $10,000 gift, but I think the average was probably $30 or $40 across that campaign. So, you know, Charity Water Now we've raised over $750 million, which is a lot of money.
It's amazing.
You know, we raise about $100 million a year, and that's really thanks to this unbelievably generous community of givers all around the world, who show up for clean water. And, you know, every single amount counts. And the 100% model, you know, to this day, 17 years later, is one of the top reasons why people say they are giving. Because if they only have $100 to give, or $5,000 or $10,000, they know where it's all going. And they know that 100% of that is going to help people get water. And they can see that impact. So, you know, look, we've helped 17 million people. As we record this today, there are 700 million people who don't have water. So you put our, you know, our 17 into the 700, and it's 1/40th of the work that needs to be done. You know, it's 1/40th of the way there. So we are really focused on growing the community, on scaling the organization to, I mean, we think that number should be zero. You know, we really believe we can work with people, you know, just like the people listening, to create a day where everybody has access to clean water and nobody goes without life's most basic need.
I mean, you know, and you know, I think ironically, you don't ever want things to shut down, but what a great day it would be if you could actually shut down Charity Water because everybody has access to clean water, and go back to your original idea of charity, what's next? Right. So let's hope in our lifetime you can do that. And I think, you know, you've got some incredible, incredible partners out there. But what I've certainly found about you and the team at Charity Water is just what you were talking about, whether it's $10 or $10 million, every bit counts.
Yeah.
Every bit's important. And I think that's really key for anybody that's listening today that wants to be a part of it is like, it doesn't matter if you don't have $1,000 to give this year. That's not the point. If you have $10 to give this year, you're helping somebody somewhere.
That's right. I mean, it only costs $40 to give somebody access to clean water, which is kind of crazy to think about that. You know,
crazy.
For $40, and the stuff that we spend $40 on, you know, without thinking often. And it's $10,000 to give an entire community clean water. And we've had people cancel vacations. We've had people, you know, who are going to go out and buy one car, decide to buy a cheaper car and donate the difference. You know, we've been really inspired by, you know, so much generosity around the world.
And
you know, there's a way people, we have a great video. If you go to thespring.com, there's a video that's gotten over 100 million views across platforms, and you can kind of see some of the images. You know, it's one thing to, you know, maybe to hear me talk about it, but it's another to actually see it, and also to see a well-being drilled and you know, hundreds of people celebrating and clapping and dancing and singing. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing to be able to provide water to people.
I reference back to the photo that I said I have of yours hanging on the wall at home, and it's a photo of a child's hands with water, clean water running into their hands. And it's something that we see every day at home, and something that, you know, talking about kids, I've told my kids about and told my kids the story about. And funny enough, I still have my charity water shirt from the charity ball, however many years ago that was. I'm not going to show our age, that says charity colon on the front and then water on the back, that I still wear. So it hasn't worn out, but I think that's hopefully I can, when you retire the charity, I'll keep that shirt and we can frame it when that day comes. So I back to your photojournalism a bit. I want to talk a little bit about your book.
Sure.
The book that's out there. And I think the name is really so appropriate for it, Thirst. And it was sort of, as I took it, and I don't know if this was intentional or not, but I took it as sort of your thirst to do something better with your life.
There's a little double entendre there,
yeah,
for sure.
Right. So can you talk a little bit about how that process happened? What inspired you to write a book? Because I think there are a lot of people out there that have really amazing stories, and the fact that you could capture yours so somebody could take it with them anywhere is a really interesting one. But tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, it took about took 2 years. I think I wanted to hit the 10-year mark of Charity Water to really, you know, write the book. And it felt like, hey, a decade of stories, a decade of impact would be a great place to try to share it in a different form, just to get this on more people's radar. So yeah, I wrote it. I worked with a woman, you know, I was running the company at the time and had young kids, and, you know, she kind of followed me around and, came to Africa with me and, you know, really helped me. I love the writing process as a journalist and, you know, getting my starts with Mercy Ships, but, this woman, Lisa, was a huge help to me kind of putting everything together and, crafting the structure. I'm not great at that. And then I think we were just, you know, so surprised to see it become a New York Times bestseller and really go out and take the message of clean water to places where, you know, it hadn't gone before. I think you know this, but I donated 100% of the book advance and all the future proceeds or profits straight back to the organization. So, you know, as it got translated into different languages and such, you know, I could never make a penny from the book, which also felt kind of nice.
Yeah.
You know, that it would just go and further the mission. And we'd hear stories of somebody reading it and, you know, making a huge gift because they were moved by the stories in it. I get to speak to a bunch of universities who have it as required reading for students.
Oh, cool.
In business classes or, you know, for philanthropy classes. So it's been a fun journey. I don't think I have another one in me, though. I don't know. Maybe not for at least another 10 years. It was a bear.
It's on that note about, you know, university students reading it. If you could give a piece of advice to somebody that was you when you were 28, somebody out there that's just trying to find themselves and figure out what to do next, and, you know, what would you tell them? You know, and question seems a little bit cliche, but I'm just thinking about, like, you know, your moment just happened. What would you tell somebody?
I mean,
I
think go find something. Well, you know, first of all, I would encourage people to ask the question of how they can use their time and their talent and their money in the service of others. You know, as you look around the world and you see suffering, unnecessary suffering in your local community, in the global community, how can you become a part of the solution? How can you end some of that needless suffering with what you've been blessed with? And I think that looks different for a lot of people. I think if you're, you know, thinking about a career in this, you know, what is not okay on your watch? You know, I have a bunch of friends working in the sex trafficking space, and, you know, for them, it is absolutely not okay that a child is ever abused, is ever put at risk. You know, for me, it's not okay that a single human being on earth goes without clean water every single day. I've got friends, you know, working in the space of shelter or healthcare or education. So I think it's kind of, you know, and for me, I needed proximity to the issue.
Sure.
You know, I don't think if I'd gone on a church mission trip for 5 days, you know, to go paint the orphanage the sixth color it had been painted that year, you know, I don't think that would have left enough of an indelible impression on me to change the course of my life. So I think, you know, in the ways that you can find an immersive experience, you can find proximity to this issue that you think you might be interested in pursuing, the more time, the better. You know, that year for me was really, I can't imagine having my life change in a week or even 2 weeks, but a year changed the course of my life.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I think what you've done successfully too is you've also modernized the idea of charity, not just in the transparency in what you do and the transparency in where the dollars go, but also even in just the creative approach to it, which has made it right for a new generation of givers. And I think there's somebody behind you that, you know, maybe is at home right now, it's 3 or 4 years old, that's going to be the next one to do that. And I'm excited to watch that grow, but I love that advice. I want to just kind of wrap up with one quick question for you that I ask everybody that's on my podcast, and you've done this a little bit already yourself, but one of the things that we get to do at the store and online is we get to share the powerful stories of people like you that have found a purpose in their lives and have dedicated their lives to doing good for people. And we're lucky to get to tell their stories. If you had to pick someone, living, dead, famous, infamous, just random Joe on the street, to tell the Scott Harrison story, when all is said and done, who would you pick to tell your story and why would you pick them?
Oh my gosh. You know, I'm trying to think of great things that I've read. And the book that comes to mind, I'm going to have to Google this, is one of my favorite autobiographies ever, is Open by Andre Agassi. The guy that wrote that is a fantastic. And I'm not a huge tennis fan, but one of the best pieces of writing, let's see what the author's name is. Gosh, I haven't even thought about this. Well, I don't even know, cause it's like ghostwritten, but it's, they put his name on it, but the guy who wrote it was incredible. So Open by, he didn't even get billed on it.
Wow.
That's crazy.
Oh. But that guy.
That guy.
That's cool. Interesting. And I think, you know, that's sort of just kind of pulling that all together. I think what's been so inspiring about you and your story is that you've been open the whole time. And you have been very forthcoming with what your life was and the drugs and the drinking and the smoking and the models and all that stuff. And really, you know, a lot of people would pretend that that never happened because their life had changed and they had started changing so many lives. And I appreciate that honesty in you. And you know, hopefully that ghostwriter that's out there maybe is listening.
J.R. Moringer.
There you go.
And he won the Pulitzer Prize for newspaper feature. So he's, yeah.
So maybe J.R. is listening and he's going to give you a call.
There you go.
Perfect. Scott, well, thank you so much. I appreciate the time today. I'm certainly excited to be able to continue to share your story with more people. We're sharing it at the store this month. We're sharing it, you know, on our social media this month. And so I think continue doing the good work you're doing. And let's raise a glass to no more need for clean water, because everybody has access in our lifetime.
Awesome. Thanks so much for the opportunity.
Yeah. Take care. Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Good Market Podcast. A new episode will drop the second Tuesday of each month, so make sure you subscribe wherever you're listening. Give us a like, a follow, and a share, and please leave a review so that we can reach even more people and grow even more good. Tune in next time to hear more stories from good people with great products supporting exceptional causes. We'll see you next month.